So if you've got your Bibles, I want to encourage you to turn to Mark chapter 5. We'll be throwing some verses up on the screen. And we want to talk about this text today, chapter 5. We're going to start in verse 21. So is Jesus for me? So we've been doing this series, Just Jesus, kind of walking through Mark. Mark gives us just kind of the bare facts, the play-by-play action of Jesus and his ministry. And so today I want us to kind of meditate, think upon this question, is Jesus for you? Is he for me? So there's a lot of people in the world. We live in a crowded world. And often our idea is that I must not be good enough. I must not be smart enough. I must not be important enough. Does Jesus really care about me? And so today, the answer to that is going to be yeah. Yes, he does. He's for you. He cares about you. But I think there is a little bit of a catch to the gospel. Jesus is for you. He is for you. He created you. He created everything you know. So there's a real sense that he's for you. But the truth is, you have to be for him in faith to receive all of his benefits. So some of you may know, this week we started a season that a lot of Christians celebrate called Lent. And so Ash Wednesday was the beginning of that, and the idea is that you sacrifice something, you kind of fast something starting on Ash Wednesday all the way to Easter. You give up something. Usually what I most often hear is like it's chocolate, right? Anybody ever given up chocolate for Lent? I know I've given up some things before for Lent, and sometimes I don't. The Bible doesn't really command us to do that, but I can see how there's some value. Somehow my kids learned about this. I wasn't really even encouraging them, but we happened upon this conversation between my two oldest. There's Phoebe, who's 8, and Gus, who is 6. Gus is my son. He's all boy. He runs around and usually doesn't do everything he's told to do. Anybody sympathize? Anybody praying for me? Got 4 of these little creatures I live with. But anyway, the oldest two were talking, and then Phoebe, who is sweet and precious, she was really trying to encourage Gus to give up something for Lent. So she told him that she was giving up, first of all candy. All candy. We don't even know really where this came from, but she said she gave up all candy. I don't think she has ate candy since Wednesday. But she also, for some reason, she was getting radical. She was like, I'm going to give up wheat. Wheat. We don't know why or how she came up with that. And she broke it like immediately because it's very hard to eat food without eating wheat. When she asked her little brother, like, what are you going to give up? And you know what he said? I'm giving up vegetables. I'm going to give up vegetables. Like, I will sacrifice that for the Lord for 40 days. I will eat nothing green. I will eat no vegetables. Now, you're laughing because you know, like, he doesn't like vegetables, you know? So he's willing to give that up. And we always have this conversation with Gus about vegetables, you know? And it's funny, I don't, you know, give him, like, we do give him some challenging things I didn't grow up with. Like, we'll give him some spinach. We'll give him some Brussels sprouts. I'm looking for confirmation. I don't know what all these things are called. But we do give out in our home a variety of vegetables. And his reply is, I don't like them, you know? And then what do we tell him? Well, they like you, right? But and the idea that that's a funny little conversation to have with a 5-year-old. But the truth is, vegetables are for you. We might say, like, they're good for you. But there is a sense where you have to be for them to get their benefits. Is this making any sense? Like, vegetables are good, they're for you, but you have to be for them and take them in. And so there's a truth to this about the Christian life. So Romans 8:30 says this. What shall we say to these things? Paul's been talking about the mess of life, the difficulty of life, kind of how we were praying earlier. There are all these things in life that seem like they're coming against us. But he says this, what shall we say to all these things? If God is for us, who can really be against us? And so today, as we look through Mark, as we keep journeying through the ministry of Jesus, and we see just Jesus, we see who Jesus is, we're going to certainly see that this his word, like Romans 8:30, that God is for us. Jesus is for us. His life will testify to this too, that he is for us. But we're gonna ultimately need to see that we need to be for him to receive his benefits in our life. We need to be for him in faith. So here's what I want to do today. It's going to be a typical kind of sermon thing. There's going to be four things that we see, and they're going to be lessons about faith as we watch these two incredible miracles unfold in Mark chapter 5. But I want us to make another list down at the bottom of your sheet, if you see that. Who are the types of people that Jesus is for? I mean, who did he minister to? Who did he care about? Who did he walk with? And so we're going to have a bigger list. So let's get started on this first list. Lord, help us as we read your word. But the first thing that I want you to see when you think about who Jesus is for, Jesus, first of all, is for those who humbly come to him for renewal. Those who humbly come to him for renewal. Let's start reading verse 21. And we're going to see Jesus, verse 21, when Jesus had crossed again in the boat to the other side of the sea. We remember that Jesus is doing a lot of ministry around ocean, around a sea called the Sea of Galilee. And he went there because that's where a lot of people were. So if you remember what we last preached about, he went to the other side of the sea, to the Gerasene area, and he healed a man plagued with demons, possibly thousands of demons inhabiting one gentleman. And we see that he was self-injuring himself. He was also locked in chains. He lived in a graveyard. He was probably the most the biggest mess in the whole Bible. In the whole Bible, this guy that Jesus healed was probably the worst off person in the whole Bible. His life was a mess, but Jesus comes and heals him. So then he comes back to the main part of his ministry on the other side of the sea. And verse 21 says that a great crowd gathered around him, and he was beside the sea. So then we meet a new guy coming, throwing himself on the mercy of Jesus. Verse 22, there came one of the rulers of the synagogue. We'll talk about what this probably was, what a ruler of the synagogue was. And he's named here. His name was Jairus. And seeing him, when Jairus saw Jesus, he fell at Jesus' feet. Verse 23, he implored him earnestly, saying, "My little daughter is at the point of death." So he had this daughter who is deathly ill, about to die. And so he's coming to Jesus with a prayer request, isn't he? He's falling on the mercies of Jesus. He falls down and he's saying, "I have a daughter who is at the point of death. Come lay your hands on her so that she may be made well and live." An incredible statement of faith here. Put your hands on her and I believe that she'll be made well and she will live. And the first part of verse 24, talking about Jesus, it says that he went with this man. So who is Jesus for? Who is Jesus for? I read this week, or last week, a story about someone going to a church, and they went into the church, and it was an older congregation. People were up in age, most of the people, and the preacher was up there preaching about how, man, we've really got to make an impact in our world. We have to make an impact in our community. We got to start reaching out to the less fortunate, to people that are poor, maybe to the homeless, to people struggling. And a funny thing was, he noticed that there was a group of people at the entrance of the church. And he saw that they were actually all basically homeless people. And he went to talk to one of them, and this is the first time this guy had ever been to this church, and he invited the guy to come sit with him in his pew. I think it was a church with pews, not lazy boy recliners like us. But he invited this guy to come sit with him, and the homeless guy refused. He said, "No, we're not allowed to come sit up there." The church leaders, they made a division in the church. And they said, like, these people, the homeless, sit over here, and everybody else sit over here. Do you think God's pleased with things like that? Well, I don't. Because I think God is for all types of people. God is for everybody. And sometimes we begin to live a different life than God wants us to live. God cares about our situation. He cares about our struggle. So let's just look at this text, the types of people Jesus is for. First of all, Jesus is for religious people like Jairus, right? And you can put this on your list. He is for religious people down at the bottom. This guy is named Jairus. And remember, we have the book of Mark because the person Peter and the person Mark, about a generation after Jesus rose from the dead, they created this book to teach people in Rome about the ministry and the life and the salvation, the gospel of Jesus. So we get different details because this guy Peter, who is walking with Jesus, gives us details. So this religious leader, he was the leader of the synagogue. He probably wasn't a paid leader. He was a lay person. He probably read the scriptures. He probably cared for the building. The synagogue was a place where Jews could go to hear the word read and fellowship and kind of have some teaching and worship the Lord together. And this guy is a leader, and he was probably an important guy. So I think I have up on the screen, he is for grown men of importance. He's for grown men of importance. He cares about even this. Sometimes when we read the scripture, we may think, well, like, Jesus doesn't care about religious people. Jesus doesn't care about important kind of famous people. But the truth is, he does. He cares about Jairus in this story. He cares for little daughters. To Jesus, children are important. And sometimes in our culture, especially in Jesus' culture, children were really marginalized. They were to be maybe seen, probably never really seen, and definitely never really heard. Right? And Jesus, even as a 12-year-old, he got into one of these synagogues, right? And he started teaching people as a little kid. One of his disciples, John, might be just a little bit older than a 12-year-old, but Jesus found children to be really important. This is pretty incredible that this would have been one of the forgotten individuals of the world. A little daughter is dying. Well, this happens. People wouldn't have cared a whole lot. But Jesus cares. Jesus goes with Jairus. We're going to see in the story that Jesus is for little daughters. I was reading an article about the current state of China and their economy and things like that. And you know, about a generation ago, for about two generations, China gave people great incentives to abort female children, to the point where you would even get taxed if you had more than one child. Also, you just felt that there were horrible opportunities if you had a girl. So more and more little girls were aborted in China. And the mess in China right now is that there are tens of millions of men, grown men now, who don't have women to marry. And there's all kinds of weird situations where there's like virtual wives going on and just a bunch of, like, you know what happens when men get left alone, right? Like stuff goes bad. So there's some issues in China because they decided for generations, let's just kill little girls. But Jesus cares about little girls, and He goes, Jesus is for desperate people. Real quick, as we think about Jesus is for those who humbly come to him for renewal, it's important to see how this man comes to Jesus, because we need to come to Jesus the same way. He comes earnestly in fear. right? He is in a desperate situation. He comes worshipfully with humility. It says that he fell at the feet of Jesus in a posture of worship, a posture of humility. And he also came expectantly in faith. He said, Jesus, I know you have the power to heal my daughter. If you could just lay your hands on her, she would be well and she would have life. And so we see here, Jesus, he went with him. Some scholars call what Mark is doing as he's writing the story, he begins one miracle story, and in the middle of that miracle story, he puts another miracle story to make what scholars sometimes call a miracle sandwich. And I want you to know that Jesus is a miracle sandwich, not a miracle whip sandwich, but a miracle sandwich coming your way. Right? He gets interrupted here. Do you guys ever feel like you've been interrupted in your life? I know I just mentioned earlier I have four kids. My life feels like a constant interruption train is coming. I feel like interruption sandwiches are always happening in my life. Kids are always coming in and talking, and we love them. It's great. We got to be like Jesus, right? But Jesus here, he is interrupted. He's ultimately interrupted by Jairus, isn't he? Like he's going to preach the gospel and a guy interrupts him. And now we're going to see that another thing interrupts him. Now the thing that's interesting about Jesus and his power and his sovereignty and that he is king over all, Jesus, it may seem like Jesus gets interrupted, but the truth is Jesus never really gets interrupted because it's all a part of his plan. Isn't that right, family? So even when you think you're interrupting Jesus with your prayer, realize that he's ready for you to interrupt him. And part of his plan is even that he can connect to you when you interrupt him. So Jesus is for those who humbly come to him for renewal. And then number two, he is for the hopeless seeking hope in him. Jesus is for the hopeless seeking hope in him. So I'm glad my son Gustin here is out in the audience. We named him a little bit after myself. My name's Austin, and we say that we put a G in Austin, and we got his name. But there's also an early church father that was very influential named Augustine. And I wanted to show you a quote that he said. This is a pretty powerful quote. He said, faith is believing in what you don't see, and the reward of faith is seeing what you would believe. You just think about that a little bit. I can't remember if I put that on your paper or not. You might want to jot that down and think about that this week. Faith is believing in what you don't see. That's true, isn't it? Like we can't see Jesus right now. We can, in a sense. We have his word. We have his word, and it is a faithful testimony. It gives us accurate information about his life, and we can see, we can experience Jesus in that way. But he's not literally here for us to touch and to experience. But so faith is believing without seeing, but the reward of faith is one day you will see what you've believed in. And that's the gospel, family. Faith has this incredible payoff where one day we will fully experience the miracle that is Jesus. So faith is believing in what you don't see, and the reward of faith is seeing what you believe. So let's keep reading here in verse 24. A great crowd followed him and thronged about him. They were all up in his business. They were all around him. They were real close to him. I might have you write down at the bottom of this thing as you think about the type of people that Jesus is for. Jesus is for people who feel lost in the crowd. Jesus is for people that feel lost in the crowd. And I think Baltimore is a city, it's an area filled with people who feel lost in the crowd. Jesus finds himself right in the midst of the crowd. And something happens. Look at verse 25. There's this desperate, hopeless woman. In verse 25, we're going to meet her. She's not named in Mark. And there was a woman who had a discharge of blood for 12 years. So this has something to do with female illnesses and menstruation. And this woman has a sickness. And in this culture, this was a hopeless case. Because not only is she continually losing iron and has a serious health deficiency, also the culture around her would see her to be cursed by God and worthless and outcasted. They wouldn't talk to her. They would never shake her hand. They would never touch her. They would never get around her because they saw her as unclean. So I want you to write down at the bottom of your page, Jesus is for people who don't think they're clean. Jesus is for the unclean. Now, the incredible thing that we're ultimately going to see here is that Jesus does touch her. She touches him, and he, we clearly see, is for those lost in the crowd, those that are unclean. He is for the hopeless seeking hope in him. So a few years ago, well, about 18 months ago, my wife had a child, and like I said, that's the fourth child we've had, and I've been in the room each time, and I am so glad that like the third child we had, we almost had it in the car. Like, it came quick. And I am so glad that we made it to whatever room and we had whatever medical professional helping us deliver that child, because I don't know if I could have done it on my own. But after four, maybe I know how to do it. Just kind of catch and hope for the best. But there was a doctor that delivered babies in 1818. His name was Ignaz Philip. And he came up with a novel idea about delivering babies. He was a long time ago, like an OBGYN kind of doctor. And he came up with an incredible idea. You know what the idea was? I need to wash my hands before I deliver babies. Because doctors in that day, they would do autopsies, they would do everything with the human body. Sorry, this sermon's got some earthy parts to it. But this doctor, he said, you know what? I think that mothers will die less if we wash our hands after we do autopsies and then deliver babies. And as you probably guessed, he was right. But everyone thought he was crazy. They thought he was a kook because he would tell people to wash their hands after they maybe did an autopsy and then delivered a baby. And ultimately, his findings have saved hundreds of lives. And why? Because when you're unclean, you shouldn't do that, right? If your hands are not clean, there's certain things you shouldn't be doing, and one of them is delivering babies. But I want you to know that Jesus is able to make us clean. He is to make us clean, and so he is for the unclean. So listen to what this woman went through in verse 26. She had suffered much under many physicians, right? By the way, this word physicians, in the original Greek that this book was written in, this word physician actually sounds a lot like the name Jesus. Jesus would have sounded something like Yeshua. And ultimately, the word save or heal is basically the word for physician. And so Jesus' name literally means doctor. So anyway, she had suffered much under many physicians, and she had spent all that she had and was no better, but rather grew worse. So not only did this woman suffer because she had an illness, but she also suffered because she sought a man-centered cure, right? She suffered more because she went to the doctors. The kind of things that doctors probably tried to get her to do, and I don't want to go into too much detail. I don't know a whole lot about it either, but the kind of things that doctors had her do made her worse instead of better. But then, family, she heard about Jesus. Look at verse 27. She had heard the reports about Jesus and came up behind him in the crowd and touched his garment. I want us to pause here just a moment and realize that Jesus has called us to be Jesus to other people. And I want you to say, I want you to kind of take in the idea that whatever process, whatever you find yourself busy doing, the moment that you get interrupted might be the best ministry that could happen that week. So Jesus gets interrupted, and then he gets interrupted during his interruption by this woman. But I want you to see what unfolds here. Because the woman, what an incredible statement of faith. If I could just touch his garments, I would be made well. And immediately, verse 29 says, the flow of blood dried up, and she felt in her body that she was healed of her disease. She was miraculously healed. So at the bottom of your page, I want you to write this too. We've said he's for the unclean, he's for those lost in the crowd. He is for those who are compelled to faith. So the audience that Mark and Peter are writing to in Rome, they would have remembered another person hundreds of years before, actually about 400 years before Jesus. There was another person who operated under the delusion that they were God. His name was Alexander the Great. And he would come into villages, and he would offer himself up as this powerful healer, and he would hold out his capes and stuff, and people would come and try to touch his cape, and the idea is that they could touch Alexander the Great's cape, they would receive some of his power. So as they're telling this story, as this really happened, they're thinking they knew that Alexander the Great wasn't really God, and that he really wasn't even a good person, and that he was really kind of crazy. But ultimately, this Jesus, though, truly was the Son of God. Because just at touching his clothes, one could be healed. So we read that quote about faith. Let's talk about faith a little bit more. There's something about faith that at the core of faith, there has to be desperation. So let me say this. Think about this. Faith is impossible to fabricate. Have you ever thought about that? Like, you can't make yourself have faith. You can't make yourself have faith in Jesus. Something has to compel you. You have to find yourself in a place of desperation. In fact, real faith, even for us now, comes out of a desperation where we say, Lord, I have gone to everything in the world. I have tried everything. But if I could just get a piece of Jesus, I think I could be healed. I think I could be made right. So an aspect of faith has to have this desperation that there's nowhere else for me to go. And so I wrote this in my notes. I said this, and I don't know if I heard this somewhere or if this came out of my heart or if it's in the Bible, but I think it's true. Faith is less of something you have and more of something that has you. You think about that? Faith is less of something you have and more of something that has you. So in chapter 4, verse 20, Jesus talks about the seeds that go out, and it falls on the bad soil, and it doesn't grow. But when he talks about it falling on the good soil, in verse 20 of chapter 4, it talks about, Jesus was talking about people hearing the word, accepting the word, and then seeing results. And that's exactly what this woman does. She hears about Jesus. She embraces it, she touches him, she reaches out for him, and she sees results. So Jesus is for those who humbly come to him for renewal. He is for the hopeless who are seeking hope in him. And then number three, he is for those who come before him with trembling faith, with fear. I want you to know, family, Jesus is for those who are lost in the crowd. And here's the reality, family, today. You cannot go unnoticed by Jesus. You cannot go unnoticed by Jesus. See, this woman, she has lived in shame for 12 years. Probably, some scholars I've read say that probably all she owned was probably like kind of a state-mandated cushion that she sat on all day, that had to be dealt with in a different way every other day. That's all she had. And she sat on the street corner in shame and in pain, every single day. And her idea is, if I can just sneak up on Jesus and touch his clothes, maybe I don't want to be noticed, because I hate to be noticed because I'm filled with shame. But family, you can't go unnoticed by Jesus. Jesus allows us to interrupt him. Look at verse 25. It says, while he was still speaking, 30. And Jesus perceiving in himself that power. So Jesus is interrupted. He knows something has happened. He says he perceived in himself that power had gone out from him. So this is the first time that Mark in his gospel uses the word power, talking about Jesus. It's the Greek word dunamis, which is where we get the word dynamite. So Jesus is saying, man, some dynamite just came out of me. The power of Jesus. And family, as a young church plant, as people wanting to see God do some stuff, we have to get a little obsessed about the power of God. We always say we want to be a part of something. We want to see God do something that that could never be blamed on us, that could only be blamed on him. And we need to see his power. And chapter 4 and chapter 5 is all about the power of God. Jesus came, he sent out his word, he's sending out his seed, he's sending out his people, and he will do amazing, powerful things. Jesus has power over the storm. He's out in a boat, and a satanic storm is rising up that is higher than they can see, and they're afraid they're going to die, the men of God, the men traveling with Jesus. And Jesus just looks at the storm and says, calm down, why don't you? And then it does. Jesus has power over nature. Jesus has power over the satanic assault that was coming over this man. There's this incredible story in Acts chapter 19. It's one of the funniest stories in the Bible. There's these Jewish exorcists. You guys know what exorcist is? People that cast demons out of people. And so there were guys that were practicing Jews. And they go in and they go into the village and they're kind of finding the monstrous man. And they go to his house. And he has one demon in his body. And they have seven of them. They have seven. There's seven Jewish exorcists. They go into the house. And this is their plan. They go into the house and they start talking with the demon, and they say, in the name of Jesus and Paul, we want you to come out of this man. And the demon talks to them. One demon. He says, I know Jesus. I've heard of Paul. Paul was an early church leader that preached Jesus. I've heard of him. But the demon looked at him and said, but who are you? See, they didn't really know Jesus. They didn't have a relationship with Jesus. They were just trying to use, like, Jesus magic. And by the way, Jesus magic isn't real. And they were just trying to say, if I can say Jesus, this demon will hop out and we'll be famous Jewish exorcists. And so it says that the man possessed by the demon jumped on these seven men who are trained professionals at casting out demons. And he beats them up and they run out of the house naked. That's one demon does that. But let me tell you about your Jesus. He finds a man who's the biggest mess in all of the Bible. We talked about it last week. You can go look up our sermon. But he isn't just possessed by one demon. He's possessed by thousands of demons. And Jesus looks at him, and the demons start begging him not to torture them. Jesus starts talking to the thousands of demons in one man, and he just says, go, and they go. Jesus has power over the storm. Jesus has power over the supernatural. He has power over the demons, even the demons you face every day. And we see here, he has power over diseases. Our Jesus does. He heals this woman with a touch. And we're going to see as we continue that he has power over death. And so here in this moment, he is for those who come before him with trembling faith and fear, and he perceived that power came out of him. Look back again at verse 30. It says, immediately he turned around to the crowd and he said, who touched my garments? You can't go unnoticed by Jesus. And the disciples said to him, what are you talking about? You see the crowd pressing around. Like, who touched you? Everybody touched you. There's a huge crowd around you, Jesus. Why are you saying who touched me? In 32, he looked around to see who had done it. But the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came in fear and trembling and fell down. I think she's shaking because she's overwhelmed at the kind of power that Jesus has. And she comes before his presence and she throws herself down before him and she told him, I like this, the whole truth. She told her story to Jesus. She told her desperation to Jesus. She told what had happened to her. And look at what verse 34 says. And he said to her, look at what he calls her, daughter. You can't go unnoticed by Jesus. He has power over your problems, and he can call you daughter when you have faith. Do you see the next word? Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your disease. Now, this is an interesting thing to say because she's already healed of her disease, isn't she? But Jesus is taking it to the next level. He's saying you have a deeper disease. You have a sin disease. Your body is messed up for 12 years, but your soul will be under the judgment of God and in hell for eternity. And I'm telling you that if you have true faith, your soul will be healed and your disease will be fully healed. So I wrote here, he is for the unnoticed. He is for the daughters. I have a picture of this woman. I read this in Time magazine a few months ago, and I wanted to pull it up and show you the picture of these two women. This is Bindu and her friend. I'm going to butcher this name. They're Indian. They're from the country of India. Bindu is the taller lady, and her friend is Kana Kadurga. And they were in India. They're from India, and they're Hindu. They worship a false god. They worship a Hindu god named Sabarimala. I'm great with these names. I should have looked these up, shouldn't I? They worship Sabarimala and probably several other gods and other Hindu gods. And they, since childhood, always wanted to go to this temple. There's a picture of the temple down there. But you were not allowed to approach that temple if you were a woman of menstruating age. So basically, you had to go through menopause, and then maybe women could go and visit this temple of their god. Well, these two women, kind of in the spirit of kind of our age and in like a women's right kind of thing in India, they went to the temple even though they had not been through menopause yet. And they went to the temple and they worshiped this god, Sabarimala. And then they were chased out of there by temple priest. And for months, they fled for their life because they broke the cultural norm of a woman approaching a sacred place like this temple. And they were fleeing for their lives for months, just driving from hotel to hotel. They had bodyguards. And it was a pretty kind of amazing story. But in my heart, as I read the story, I prayed for these women that I just have seen their picture. And my prayer is that they would be those that come like this woman before Christ with trembling and fear, because Christ will embrace them. And they won't go oppressed and unnoticed by Jesus. So maybe today you say, well, I'm not really in a storm. I don't think I'm possessed by demons. Right? I don't have a disease. Well, here comes something applicable for you. Death. Right? A 12-year-old's going to die in the last part of the story that we're going to read. But ultimately, one day, so are you. So you came to church today to learn some encouraging news. You're going to die. You're going to face death, right? Everyone goes home, man, I love Austin. He always reminds me I'm going to die. That's right. That's what the Bible's here for. We're going to die. So let me tell you this. This last thing, because all of us in here, we are all people who, just like this little girl, just like these ladies, just like all the people in this background image, we're going to die. Listen to the last point. Jesus is for the dead who come to life in him. Let's read what happens when Jesus gets to Jairus' house and meets his daughter who is dying. Actually, something happens before he gets there. Most people believe this truth. They believe life is temporal and death is forever. Jesus came to reverse that. Jesus came to bring us life forever and to make death temporal. So when we think about, there's an important day coming for you, and it's your, one time I preached a series to some teenagers, some 13-year-olds and stuff, and I preached about the five most important days of their life, or the four most important days of their life. The first was the day they were born, the one was the day that they chose Jesus, and the third most, probably the most important day was the day they were going to die. The day you die. I think there's a movie here called Death Day. I don't have a clue what it's about. I probably don't think you should go watch it. but that's an important day, the day that you die. How do you see that day? Well, if you have the faith in Jesus, if you've met Jesus, you see it as just a simple passage. A day that gets me to eternity. A day that gets me to everlasting joy. And no, I'm not saying we need to make that day come quicker, but I want you to know that Jesus came here to show us that life is forever and death is temporal. So he does this in this miracle. Let's read this. So while he was still speaking, he was interrupted. He's talking about faith with this woman who came. There came someone from the ruler's house. Remember, we know his name. His name was Jairus. He's an important guy. He's got important people. So someone's coming to him, and they came from the ruler's house, and they said to him, this is pretty blunt, your daughter is dead. Your daughter is dead. Why trouble the teacher any further? Why are you going to even worry with Jesus? Stop interrupting Jesus. Your daughter is dead. It's hopeless. Verse 36, but overhearing what they said, Jesus said to the ruler, his name's Jairus, remember, of the synagogue. Jesus cares about him. Jesus cares about this little girl. So Jesus said to them, do not fear, only believe. This is what we talked about last week, wasn't it? It's the same kind of response in the storm to the disciples. He said, why do you not have faith? You have chosen to have fear instead of faith. And we talk about how at every crossroad of our life, it is a chance to have faith in Jesus or have fear in our circumstances. So Jesus says, do not fear, only believe. Don't choose fear, choose faith in me. Verse 37, he allowed no one to follow him except Peter and James and John, the brother of Jesus. Now, I love little moments like this. You can pass through this, but you see the power of Jesus here? There's a crowd that won't leave him alone until he says, leave me alone. And then they stay put, right? His word is power. There's little details in there. His power. I just want you three. Come with me. I want to show you something. Everybody else stay here. Verse 38. So they came to the house of the ruler of the synagogue, and Jesus saw a commotion. People weeping and wailing loudly. Now, I'm from the South. I'm from South Carolina, and some of the biggest culture shock for me have actually been times when I've gone to funerals and wakes and things like that. It's very different than where I am from. One thing I know that in Jesus' setting, these kind of funerals would scare us to death. You would hire people that were professional. Like the only thing you could compare the kind of people you would hire to come to your funeral to help with your funeral is probably like some emo, screamo kind of rock stars, right? Like they would be at the funeral just screaming, wailing, clapping their hands. They would probably work by the hour. They would be screaming, yelling, just lamenting death. You would pay them to do it. It was required. Like you had to hire at least like three or four. Some of our source historical documents talk about. And so there are all these people. And so the word we get is there's this commotion, all this weeping and wailing loudly, because especially this is a 12-year-old dying, and in walks Jesus. Look at what it says in verse 39. And when he had entered, he said to them, "Why are you making a commotion and weeping? The child is not dead, but is sleeping." One point to make real quick here is that I believe this child is dead. This child died. The text clearly says it. That's the kind of words that are used here. There would have been professionals for the time period that would have checked a part of this whole funeral thing. They would have confirmed death. But Jesus comes in and he says the child is sleeping. She's dead, but Jesus comes in and says that she is sleeping, because what he's really trying to do is he's trying to change our perception of death. He's trying to let us see that death is a temporal thing. That one day that there will be a resurrection of all people, and they will be resurrected to eternal bliss with God or eternal judgment with God. But can you imagine, there's this commotion, just all this weeping and screaming and commotion and carrying on. And Jesus walks in and he's like, "Calm down, y'all. All right? The girl's just sleeping." Because he wants to change their perspective, not only on death, but their perspective of who he is. But look at verse 40. It says they laughed at him. They're like, "Jesus, we have checked. This girl is dead. It is ridiculous that you come in here." What right does Jesus have to come into funerals and crash funerals? So how many of you have ever crashed a wedding before? Or crashed, okay, of course, JR. Sorry, buddy. I like that honest. That's me. Gotta confess in church. What I love about Jesus, he'll crash a party every now and then, but he'll crash a funeral, right? Like, he'll go into a funeral and like, "No need to have this funeral anymore. I am here," you know? And this has to be quite a spectacle, right? Someone coming into a funeral and like, "Hey, stop it. Stop it. We're not going to have a funeral here." It is so beautiful what he does here. Look at verse 39, he says, you know, "Hey, she's just sleeping." Verse 40, they laugh at him, but he put them all outside, right? Like, just like the crowd, "You guys stay here, you three come with me. All you professional funeral people, outside." They go outside, and he took in the child's father and mother. Isn't this beautiful picture? He's got his three guys, that's what he says, and those who were with him. And he went in to where the child was. This is incredible. What's going to happen? He went in where the child is. You can picture a 12-year-old. I don't know if you've been to funerals. I don't know if you've had tragedies in your life. I've seen too many children laying in caskets. It is a disturbing sight. It's a sight that God didn't mean to happen, but our sin, our world, let it to happen. But Jesus comes in and he interrupts death. You can try to interrupt Jesus, but Jesus interrupts death. So he walks in here and he takes her by the hand. Look at this precious moment. He takes her by the hand and he said to her, "Talitha kumi." That means, "Little girl, I say to you, arise." So he says, "Talitha kumi." This actually, it's an Aramaic. It literally translates to "my little goat, get up." But little goat was like a pet name. Like I have back here, I have my little girls. Man, I love my little girls, right? I love my little girls. They can get whatever they want from me usually, right? My little girls. And I have these little pet names for them. I call Carrie Ann, I call her, she's my care bear, you know, like cuddle with her and stuff. And Phoebe, she's my Phoebe cat. She's my little pet names for him. Well, this would have been a common pet name. So what Jesus, if you remember in John chapter 11, Jesus walks up to the grave of Lazarus and he says, "Lazarus, arise," you know, and then Lazarus like comes out like a mummy and everybody's like, "Man, yeah, Jesus raised the dead." And Jesus could have walked into this little room with this little girl and he could have said, "Little girl, wake up. I got miracles to do, you know, like let's get going, get up." But he comes to her, the text says he takes her hand, and he whispers something on par with, "Sweetheart, wake up." And she does. She wakes up because Jesus is the death defeater. He said to her, "Little girl, I say to you, arise." Verse 42, and immediately the little girl got up and began walking, for she was 12 years of age. And they were immediately overcome with amazement. And then he strictly charged them that no one should know this. And he told them to give her something to eat. So Jesus, he's for hungry people, right? Like, resurrect a girl, let's get her a sandwich, you know? He cares about this little girl. But we have this secret Messiah thing too. And we remember this is because Jesus is in control of his ministry and he doesn't want his ministry to end. So these huge miracles that he does, he tells people, don't tell anybody. That's why he only had 5 people in the room when this happened, because he doesn't want the whole world knowing, because they will put a squash to the end of his ministry. And he's got some more things to teach. He has some more people to heal. And if he gets everybody knowing that he is God in a body immediately, or that's his claim, then he would make quicker his death and resurrection. We also talk about how the gospel isn't complete yet because he hasn't died. And he wants the great miracle that everybody has ringing in their ears, his resurrection and ascension. Because see, Jesus did, he raised the dead at least 3 times that we read about in the Gospels. But the difference about his resurrection is that those other 3 people, they ended up dying again. But Jesus in his resurrection, remember that he arose in like a glorified body and then ascended into heaven to live eternally. And that same Jesus that rose from the dead, that body will be the same body we experience one day when we are risen to walk with him one day. So Jesus is for the dead who come to life in him. Ephesians, the book of Ephesians says that we were all dead in our trespasses and sins, but we are made alive to walk with him because of his mercy. A few things you can write as we wrap this up down at the bottom. The types of people that Jesus is for. Jesus is for hungry people. He is for blockheads, all these people laughing at Jesus. Jesus is for his leaders. He brings in his leaders, the people he's developing to lead his church. Jesus is for people that mourn. Jesus is for people who have lost things. He's for you today if you've lost things. He does this miracle. He is for parents. Hey, I'm one of them. It is not easy to be a parent. And he is for parents. He brings that mother and father into the room. Lord, bless Jesus. He is for pre-teenage girls, right? He loves 12-year-olds. He's the man. He's awesome. Jesus is for people who are going to die. So this text reminds us that Easter is coming. Easter should really remind us that Jesus has the power over death. Jesus came to defeat death. 2 Timothy 1:10 says this, and which now has been manifested through the appearing of our Savior, our great healer, our hero, our doctor, our Savior, Christ Jesus, who abolished death and brought life and immortality to light through the gospel. Last thought, Jesus is for you. Jesus is for you. If you're in the sound of my voice today, Jesus is for you. Are you for him in faith? Be like these 2 people. Be like the people that meet Jesus in the Bible. Throw yourself upon his mercy because you need him. You'll be compelled to faith out of desperation for the power of Jesus. Sneak up on his blessings in faith. Just like this woman who sat in depression, in shame, in isolation for over 12 years. She snuck up on Jesus just to touch a hem of his garment. Just one tassel to be made whole, and he'll make you whole too. Awake like this little girl. Awake to live the new life that he has for you today.